Hi, Tamar.
Hi, Paul.
How are you doing?
I'm terrific. How are you?
I'm good. So we should introduce ourselves. Actually, what we'll do is I'll introduce you. You introduce me. You are Tamar Gendler. You're a professor of philosophy at Yale University. You're also the chair of the Cognitive Science Program. You are a renowned philosopher in metaphysics and epistemology and philosophy of psychology. You are the winner of many awards, including Mellon New Directions Fellowship. And Oxford University Press, I have heard, is going to have a collection of your recent writings on imagination and philosophical methodology.
What a lovely introduction, Paul.
Well, thank you.
Why, thank you. Well, I have the pleasure of having a conversation with Paul Bloom, who's a distinguished professor of psychology at Yale University, well known both for his scholarly work and for his work as a public intellectual. He's the author of two books, one called How Children Learn the Meaning of Words and the other a book called Descartes' Baby, which is the kind of book that one can track one's numbers on Amazon. And he's currently writing a book called How Pleasure Works, which I understand will be coming out sometime in the next year. Paul's also a distinguished teacher and winner of many awards, both academic and awards for teaching. So a treat to be talking to you, Paul.
Well, thank you. This has been fun. I guess because we're supposed to do a bit more than this. As you said, I'm writing a book about pleasure. And one major focus of my book is the pleasures of the imagination. I'm interested in what we like about fiction, about books, movies, daydreaming, television, and so on. And in this regard, my interest connects very much with yours, because I know you've done some very influential recent work where you talk about the relationship between the imagination and reality. And in particular, what I sort of thought we'd start off with is you've written a series of papers on the notion of what you call a leaf, which is a brand new term. And so maybe we should start off, but you could explain to us what a leaf means.
Good. And I'm very interested, Paul, in exploring how this connects up to your work on pleasure. So this is a terrific opportunity. So the term a leaf comes from the term belief. So belief is spelled with B-E at the beginning. A leaf is A-L-I-E-F. And the best way to explain what I mean by the notion is to give a few examples where I think it's evident that a leaf is in play. So suppose you step out on a very high glass platform above a raging river, say at the Grand Canyon, or you step out at the Empire State Building. Obviously, you believe that you're safe, or you wouldn't voluntarily put yourself into that situation. But nonetheless, you have these responses. You tremble, you shiver, you shake, you feel a certain sort of anxiety. And what I want to suggest is going on there is that you believe that you're safe, but at the same time, you have an A leaf with the content, something like really high up, scary, tremble and shudder. Let me give one additional example just to show another sort of case where it's at play. Paul Rozin, the psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, has been doing wonderful series of studies over the last 25 years where he does things like have subjects take a piece of fudge and shape it into the form of a piece of dog feces. And subjects find themselves reluctant to eat the fudge once they've shaped it into the shape of feces. Now, it's not because they believe that it's been chemically transformed as a result of reshaping it. Nonetheless, they find themselves hesitating. What's going on here? Suggestion, they believe that what they have before them is fudge, but they have an A leaf of the form, disgusting dog poop, don't eat. So those are a couple of examples of the notion.
So this approach takes the, in some way, brings the imagination and reality closer. So, you know, when we experience things that we know aren't real, like Rozin's dog poop fudge, we still, at some level, the mental representation for these is the sort that our mind doesn't care about real versus imagined. We just can't distinguish between them. What would be helpful maybe is if you could sort of what's new about this idea, to put it crudely? Like, how is this different from how philosophers commonly think about the imagination?
Good. Well, contemporary philosophy obviously encompasses a range of opinions, as the history of philosophy does. But one of the mainstream strands in contemporary philosophy has tried to read belief off behavior. So on that picture of things, if I hesitate to eat this piece of feces-shaped fudge, or if I tremble while I'm standing on the edge of a bridge, or if, for example, I cower when I'm watching a film in which violence occurs, or laugh or smile, that's taken to be indicative in some way of my believing that I'm unsafe, or that the fudge is inedible, or that somebody's been harmed or is in danger. What the notion of a leaf lets us do is actually credit people with the capacity to make the reality-imagination distinction, but nonetheless to respond in the ways that people obviously do to fictional representations and also to experiences in everyday life. And in doing this, it actually draws on one of the main insights which has been part of Western philosophy and non-Western philosophy for the last 2,500 years, which is the idea that our soul has many parts. So Plato spoke of the rational, the spirited, and the appetitive. And he recognized that the rational part of the soul can be doing one thing, believing a particular content, and that the spirited and appetitive parts of the soul can be pulling in some other direction. So in some sense, it's a very old insight, but it's a new term for describing something that's gotten a bit lost in certain strands of contemporary philosophical discussion.
So if that's a nice summary. If it's sort of in a more self-centered way, I try to bring this into psychology and maybe evolutionary psychology in particular, is it fair to say that a leaf is in some sense the default state? So an animal will be wired up, say, to respond, to be afraid of heights and to get a fear response in heights. And the simplest state doesn't care about whether it's on top of a bridge giving an illusion of height as opposed to real height. And an accomplishment of our species then would be to sort of distinguish, pull apart belief from the simpler a leaf notion.
That's exactly right, Paul. In fact, this morning I was watching one of our cats play with this toy, which is basically a bit of leather wrapped in fur. And the cat batted it about and ran about with it as it would with a mouse. Not because it was engaged in some kind of imaginative enterprise, but also not because it believed that this was a mouse. My cat was running off in a leaf system that said, furry item that smells vaguely leather-like, dash about and play with. And I think similarly, it's the most primitive state for humans. I think what an infant has at the moment of birth is a set of a leaf routines that lead to, for example, rooting behavior. We all know that if you tap a baby on the cheek, it will turn in the direction of the tap, not because it represents the tap as information about the mother, but because what happens is the activation of this sort of routine.
So, I mean, that's something we might want to turn to a bit later, because I think that that's right, what you just said. But I would argue that very quickly in development, children begin to get an appreciation of reality versus pretense. Very early, say before their first birthday, they have some understanding that something could represent itself as real, but not be real. And then I would say that putting in your vocabulary, that would be a case where true beliefs begin to emerge as distinct from aliefs.
I know we're supposed to disagree, Paul, but
sorry, go ahead.
I actually suspect that I agree with you about the developmental evidence. I think the Piaget case of his child playing with the blanket in a kind of pretense-like peekaboo way before the age of one is a convincing one. So this is just to say, yes, I think you're right, that it's very early that these distinctions come on board in normally developing humans.
And this is going to come back when we talk about fiction and imagination, how we respond to movies and video games and so on. But there's one thing I wanted to bring this back to, which is I know I've read in some of your work, you argue that the notion of a leaf, when we properly think about it, actually has real-world implications for how we should live our lives.
Yes, one of the ways of getting at that is by thinking about the ancient roots of the notion. So I said a few minutes ago in response to your question of where this fits in the history of philosophy, that in some way a leaf is capturing what the early modern philosophers would have called the passions, or what the ancient philosophers would have called the spirited or appetitive parts of the soul. And one of the ideals towards which both Western and Eastern philosophy have been striving is an ideal of harmony of the soul, that somehow things go well when your reason and your passions are in line. And something that is evident to anybody who's ever engaged in therapeutic self-reflection is that life goes very well when one's reasoned commitments and one's habits are in line with one another. So one can have a reasoned commitment to sit down and write every morning, or to avoid a particular kind of substance, be it chocolate or alcohol or cigarettes, but one can have sort of patterns of innate or habitual response, what I would call a leaf, that pull in another direction. So the articulation of the notion of a leaf as a way of thinking about what it is that we want to have come into harmony can be really helpful in those aspects of living our lives. And it also has some implications for social philosophy that we may have a chance to get to.
It sounds like it connects with some work in social cognition regarding implicit attitudes, say implicit racial attitudes. So people like Mahzarin Banaji and Tony Greenwald have this implicit attitudes test, where they find that even people who are avowedly anti-racist still show, say, a correlation, some sort of sensitivity to the association of black and bad and white and good. And I guess under your vocabulary, you'd say this is a leaf rearing its head. And that to establish harmony, we should try to bring our implicit responses in accord with our explicit ones?
Absolutely. One thing that's interesting, though, is that there's a reading of the implicit attitudes test which says that it's not about attitudes, but in fact, as the name, accurate name, implicit associations test, that it's just an encoding of associations. So there's extremely interesting work by the psychologist Jennifer Richeson at Northwestern that suggests that if you take people whose IAT scores exhibit high availability for negative associations with blacks, and you put them in an interracial interaction, they will behave as politely and as unawkwardly as people whose IAT scores don't show that. But that if afterwards you ask them to engage in certain sorts of cognitive tasks, they'll exhibit exhaustion. This connects up with some work on self-regulation by Roy Baumeister, who has subjects sit in front of either a tray of chocolate chip cookies or a tray of radishes, and then afterwards they engage in various sorts of tasks, having suppressed the desire to eat those things, and they're worse at the cognitive tasks. So the idea that these studies seem to suggest is that it's actually cognitively costly to have your beliefs and beliefs out of line if you're trying to regulate your behavior to line up with your beliefs. So if you have racist associations that are even just information about your society, then keeping the set of associations under wraps while you engage in interracial interactions is going to use up some of your executive function. So we really do want not only to have our own associations match with our theoretical commitments, but also to have it be the case that the society is just in ways that we don't need to ignore information in order to have these things line up.
Okay, so be my therapist. So suppose I'm like this. I am avowedly anti-racist. I wish to be anti-racist. I wish not to hold negative stereotypes. But still, when tested on the IAT or other implicit measures, it turns out I think blacks are bad. I think Jews are greedy. I think women are not good at math. And all of these things, I don't want to think.
Right.
So what is one to do?
So
how could I bring myself?
Let me say first, I'm not sure you think those things, but you certainly have quick associations between women and bad at math and so on. So what's interesting, there's actually a large literature on changing implicit attitudes, is that the techniques that work there are exactly the sorts of techniques that would work in a therapeutic context. So if you're afraid of snakes, there's all sorts of techniques we use that involve imagination, creation of new sets of associations, engaging with representations that are gradually more and more realistic, all of which are involved in the retraining of habit. And the work on anti-racism suggests that all those sorts of techniques that work in a therapeutic context can work here as well. So one can form a counter-stereotypic image and try to make that more vivid and more available. One can engage in various sorts of creations of new associations. All of these end up being valuable techniques. But as we know about habit, once something's laid down, it's not that somehow there's a magic trick for erasing it. All that we're in a position to do is to provide some sort of overlay that's more available to us. So just as in therapy, what we want to do is train new habits of instinctive response so that, at least in the domains where we want to respond in accord with our beliefs, so that our instincts end up lining up with our theoretical commitments. This is what Aristotle called the phronimos, or the well-raised one, the person whose habitual responses were in accord with their rational commitments.
So in some ways, I mean, it fits in with something I've always been interested in, which is what to me has been the largest social change in my lifetime, which is attitudes towards homosexuals and gay marriage. Which has had this radical, at least to me, radical shift over the last many years. And I've always felt, and this is consistent with what you're saying, that the shift isn't so much that people have persuaded one another with arguments and logic and even with examples or analogies, but rather due to certain positive portrayals of gay couples and homosexuals in the media, somehow people's gut reactions have changed.
I think...
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's, I happened to be watching Fox News the other night, and there was a sort of photo montage that was presented during a report about the Prop 8 vote. And about how, it was a photo montage of a series of gay couples getting married. And about halfway through it, it occurred to me that it was being presented, at least to a certain portion of the audience, as something that was meant to be inducing a certain kind of disgust reaction.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, it looked like a bunch of happy couples finally having their connection to one another publicly acknowledged. So what had shifted was my apprehension of it and the set of associations that I had with it, in contrast to the set of associations that I would presumably have had raised in a culture 30 or 40 or 50 years ago.
And, of course, you choose your images. I mean, if this news report wanted to push you against gay marriage, obviously it would bias you to showing people sort of wrapped around in leather or portrayed in such a way that it'd be offensive. And, you know, again, the argument would be at a gut level it will affect us, even if we're not conscious of it. And, I mean, in some ways it's almost depressing, the idea that so much of our social and moral and political discourse happens below the level of consciousness. I think the role of consciousness there so much isn't so much what affects you, but your conscious choice on how to manipulate other people.
I think...
And I guess this is a... Sorry.
Continue.
This is a theme that people like John Haidt and others have argued, the role of these sort of implicit responses in moral change and political change.
I actually don't think it's that alien from the Western philosophical tradition, which it's often treated as being critical of. I do think you find in Plato, in Aristotle, in the medievals, in the early moderns, all the way through, direct acknowledgments of this. Aristotle says reason doesn't change habits. Reason just tells us what direction we want our habits to be changed in. So I think the role of reason in philosophy has always been that of seeking what it is that we want to find ourselves committed to, and that the work after that, the work of persuasion, the work of coming to find those things, natural ways of making sense of the world, is an additional project which some philosophers have seen themselves as responsible for taking on and others haven't. But I actually don't see the height line as being that different from what's apparent in much of the sensitive thought in the philosophical tradition that I'm familiar with.
Well, I think I'm very sympathetic to the height line, but I think what it tends to miss, and
Paul,
maybe this is,
I
think, what's
contained
in the philosophical tradition, is a notion that reason does play a substantial role. And
Paul,
and I think the role it tends... Sorry?
You went out of volume for me for a couple of minutes. I suppose they'll splice.
Sorry. I'm sympathetic to what height proposes, but I think what his theory misses, and what a lot of the work in contemporary moral psychology misses, is the role of reason, which is retained, of course, in the philosophical tradition, and the role of reason in generating and affecting moral change. So it seems to me undeniable that in some ways we've come to have moral change in a positive direction. And if we were just Alif machines responding to images, this would be a puzzle. And I think the way out of the puzzle is we are Alif machines at some level. We're also smart enough to think up images and stories and representations so as to sway one another and sway ourselves into changing our views. So the attitudes towards gay marriage, say, have shifted as a result of the images and views and perceptions people have, probably at a low level. But what's interesting is people who have thoughtfully made arguments one way or another manipulate these images so as to sort of cause these moral changes to happen.
I think that's exactly right, but I think it's important to remember that this doesn't only happen in cases of progress. Some of the greatest manipulators of Alif lived in Europe in the 1930s and 1940s.
Absolutely. I mean, so you see, so, you know, the going back to disgust, which is what Paul Rozin works on with his examples, so much of the propaganda against people you want to kill involved depicting them as disgusting. The Nazis would depict the Jews as vermin. And you're right, there's two things going on here. There's a simple, dumb system where you see where the German populace sees these depictions and then says, you know, Jews, gross. And then there's the high-level thing where some very smart, very terrible people contemplatively and logically and rationally decide to utilize this technique so as to change how people think. So you're absolutely right. The smart side of us is not, you know, the same as the good side of us.
And, of course, one of the most effective tools in propaganda is art. The films of Leni Riefenstahl, which were directing attention in particular ways, are one example of that, which used things like music and the massing of bodies to bring people's Alifs into a certain way. But fiction can also affect us in those sorts of ways. And one of the things I thought it might be interesting for us to explore is how the topics that we've been talking about so far fit in with some of the issues that you were addressing in the Pleasure book about why it is that people seem to enjoy fictional representations. Because I've just been talking about the ways in which we want our beliefs and Alifs to line up in certain contexts. But of course, the enjoyment of fiction,
right,
or roller coasters or bungee jumping all play off of exactly the discrepancy between what we believe, namely that we're in a position of safety, and what we Alif, that is, the sorts of experiences that we undergo as the result of this directed attention through cinematic representation or as the result of these sort of bodily engagements in the bungee jumping and roller coasters. So I wonder whether you'd be willing to say a bit about what kinds of theories have been proposed for thinking about why it is that we enjoy fiction and whether you think those theories get at what's really interesting about the phenomenon.
Yeah, it's a great issue. At one level, our appreciation of fiction and movies and stories is a huge puzzle because, you know, instead of spending our time adapting to the environment, learning about things, helping our kids, eating, drinking, fornicating, doing all sorts of evolutionarily relevant things, people spend a huge amount of time reading novels and watching television and checking out pornography on the internet and going to movies, and it seems bizarrely wasteful. It's a freak of evolution. And so a lot of smart people have said, well, maybe there's sort of a hidden adaptation function to it, maybe a hidden reproductive advantage you get from this. So maybe stories, for instance, help you learn about the world. Or maybe stories alleviate loneliness. Or maybe stories exercise your theory of mind. That is, they exercise your ability to suss out the minds of others and the intentions of others. Maybe stories serve as a way of moral instruction. And I could list about four other theories. And I think stories can do all of those things. I think stories can serve a whole lot of functions. But I'm actually convinced enough, in part convinced by what you're saying, to think that all of these explanations are superfluous. You don't need any of them. The reason why we like stories, at least to a first approximation, we'll deal with roller coasters and horror movies a bit later, but the reason why we like stories is because they depict the sorts of things that we would enjoy in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And because our minds are partially insensitive to the difference between reality and pretense, we can get pleasure from them. This is the issue of a leaf again,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, if somebody would enjoy watching people have sex, real people having real sex, they will probably enjoy watching on the internet actors and actresses pretending to have sex, or have, anyway, virtual sex. If you enjoy watching clever people have clever conversations, then watching a sitcom where it looks like clever people having clever conversations will give you pleasure. And so for 90% of things, and maybe 10% is interesting, but 90% of fictional pleasures, yes, why does somebody like that? The answer is because they like the real thing, and their minds at some level can't tell the difference.
I guess what's nice about the notion of a leaf in this kind of theory that you're proposing is that you're not then forced to say, oh, they believe that the characters on Cheers really exist. One has an explanation for how it is that what one might call the Las Vegas rule can hold for imagination. What happens in imagination stays in imagination. People don't really think that the things that happen on television are going on. But nonetheless, one can have responses to them that are akin to the responses one would have in actual cases. And of course, there's every reason to expect, given that we only have one brain, that our responses to representations of things would be much like our responses to the actual things, because it wouldn't make sense for us to have two complete systems in the brain, one of which deals with the real version of everything and the other of which deals with the imaginary version of everything. It must be that for a lot of these cases, what gets deployed are exactly the same kinds of processing routines that would be in the actual cases, though, of course, importantly, there are differences. And I'd like to hear a bit about some more perplexing cases. So what you've described explains well why we like romances, it explains well why we like comedies, it explains well why we like pornography and the food channel, but it doesn't explain very well why we like horror films, or why, as Aristotle said, we enjoy watching, there's a pleasure to watching representations of tragedy. Now, surely that's not because of the approximation of what would happen in real life. So what's your theory about what's going on in those kinds of cases?
I think they're hard cases, and they get different sorts of explanations. So there's the classic paradox of tragedy that philosophers from Aristotle, Hume, and others have talked about. And to some extent, I think this is also solved by a leaf. So you have people like Samuel Johnson saying, isn't it amazing that we're sort of moved by these things in fiction that would never move us this way in real life? We'd be repelled in real life. And of course, that's just wrong. I mean, for some reason, he's never heard of O.J. Simpson or the woman who drowned her kids. Or we are fascinated by terrible events in real life. We are fascinated by honest-to-God tragedies, and I think part of the pleasure from fictional tragedies is just a leaf. It's just that we like them in the real world, and we could talk about why, but in part just because they're socially interesting and complicated and intriguing, and so we like them in fiction. So that explains sort of part of the problem, but you're right, a real problem remains, like horror movies. So so people like, there's a genre which has come out over the last couple of years. David Denby dubbed it torture porn, where people line up and they go to the cinemas and they see innocent people being tortured to death in horrible ways. And presumably this wouldn't be as pleasant and probably would be to some extent repulsive if they were to see it in real life. And that's a question, that's a real puzzle. I think that the puzzle is related to other things that Paul Rossen, again, has called benign masochism, mm-hmm. which is we enjoy cause of giving ourselves little doses of pain. We like putting hot chilies on our food. We go into saunas. We take hot baths, roller coaster rides.
Paul, I can't hear
which
you.
Sort of court nausea and fear. In controlled doses, we like that. And what I'd like to suggest is, and this is what the argument I make in detail in my book, is that to some extent all of this could be viewed as safe practice. So it's very adaptive for an animal, including a human, to be able to practice, to try out dangerous situations in cases where there's no real danger. And I think we're compelled to. And so this is why we stop and we look at car accidents. It's why we eat hot chilies. And it's why we're sometimes drawn to see terrible things in movies that we wouldn't want to see in real life, because in movies they're safer.
Interestingly, that connects up to the classic philosophical notion of the sublime, which is discussed in ancient philosophy, but perhaps gets its fullest expression in Kant and Schiller. And the idea there is that the greatest sort of stimulation, the experience of sublimity, occurs when we're actually in a position of safety, and at some level we recognize that, but that we're confronted with something grand and dangerous and overwhelming. And so there is, I suppose, a sense in which there's a kind of arousal without risk that's available in these sorts of contexts. And I hadn't thought about the extent to which it would be adaptive to sort of play around with one's arousal in safe situations. But that seems exactly right. Though how, Paul, does that differ from the simple story which you were criticizing earlier on, that imagination is just about being able to practice things?
It doesn't. In that, I do think that that is one of the functions of imagination. I was critical of that view as a theory for why we have imagination in the first place. I think it gets the chronology wrong. I think a leaf is fundamental, basic, and goes way back. I think this idea of using a leaf for practice comes in later. I think it comes in later developmentally. I think you're right, for instance, that a baby is just a leaf machine. And then it's only later on that a baby becomes a child and is able to sort of practice using these representations. So again, this is something which I think the system is used for. I don't think it's what it's evolved for. There's another twist on this discussion for both the sort of vanilla pleasures of simulating good times and using your mind to simulate aversive experiences, which is the capacity, and this is something that we're both interested in, the human capacity to generate experiences in our own heads. Mm-hmm. So we're talking right now as if imagination and fiction is all a passive experience. You're staring at the screen and there it comes to you, and then you respond to it. But something which is really neat about people is we can create our own imaginative events. We can daydream. We can fantasize. And this is just profoundly important, and there's so many things we don't know about it. I don't know. Here's one thing we don't know about it. I have a dog, and my dog sits around and does nothing all the time. What is my dog thinking? And my worry is my dog is too stupid to daydream. My dog is not smart enough to generate imaginative experience that would be pleasurable and then while away her time. An example, monkeys presumably masturbate all the time, but I don't know if they're smart enough to have sexual fantasies while they do it.
So, Paul, I certainly agree with you that it would be unlikely if the monkey had a spontaneously generated, careful pornographic representation going on in his or her mind while he engaged in the activity that you described. But I'd also be surprised if animals who have sensory experiences didn't sometimes spontaneously experience the reliving of those sensory experiences in the way that we, without trying, dream at night, which are sort of relived experiences. There's sort of trails of association. The fact that we're able to condition animals in certain sorts of ways indicates that we can, and the evolutionary continuity suggests that there would be a kind of representational continuity. So I agree with you that there wouldn't be any sort of deliberate daydreaming. Tessie can't say, oh, I wonder what it would feel like if I were out in that field again, and then remember that. But if Tessie gets presented with a scent that she smelled while she was in the field, I'd be surprised if she didn't experience a kind of rerun of the field experience, at least at some level, while she lay there.
I totally agree. I mean, in the simplest form, that reduces to what psychologists call classical conditioning.
That's right.
So if, you know, if every time the cruel master raises his hand, he smacks the dog, then when he raises his hand, the dog will flinch. And I think the psychology of it is probably the dog feels this blast of fear, even though at the moment nothing bad is happening. So I agree with that. The interesting gap between humans and other animals, by hypothesis, and maybe between older children and younger children, is volition. The ability to sort of willfully choose from a stock of experiences and replay it. And I think that's extraordinary. I don't know when it happens in kids. I don't know when it happens from an evolutionary point of view. And I'll also add, it's not necessarily good, because you could spend all your time reliving, you know, unpleasant, humiliating experiences and ruminating on them. So it's a pleasure technology, but it's not just a pleasure technology.
That's exactly right. And Paul, actually, it connects, I think, in interesting ways to the Walter Mischel studies, which are now getting all the publicity as the result of having been mentioned, the marshmallow studies, having been mentioned first in Malcolm Gladwell's book and more recently in The New Yorker. So the idea there is that one of the things that enables children to engage in self-regulation is the capacity to represent what's before them and really there as if it were imaginary or vice versa. So one of the most effective techniques of children who are trying not to eat a marshmallow is to imagine that there's a frame around it and it's unavailable. So whenever it is that this capacity comes online, one of the things that it does is it plays in both directions. It allows you to represent what's imaginary as if it were real and engage in those pleasures, but it also allows you to distance yourself from what's real and treat it as if it were imaginary. And one might think the sort of metaphoric representations that we were talking about earlier, the strategies used in propaganda of treating your enemy and imagining him to be an animal or disgusting or non-human, are extensions of this same capacity, that we can overlay experience with a representation and then make use of our relief system, which responds to the representation, to key up motor routines or emotional responses that will accord not with the reality that lies behind the representation, but with the representation that we ourselves have generated. And that can allow for self-control in the case of the marshmallow studies, or it can allow for the kind of brutal activity that one sees in fascism or in recent African genocides and so on.
There's a line from Milton, something like, nothing is heaven or hell except that the mind makes it so.
That's exactly right. And there is a kind of anti-realist strand in philosophy, and one that's been taken on quite powerfully in literary traditions, that says what matters is not the experience but the representation of the experience. Some of the recent work on political rhetoric, which says that much of what does the affecting of people when one makes political argument is not the arguments themselves, but rather the terms in which the arguments are framed, all of that plays off of these same things. None of this is to say that there isn't a role for reason and at least degrees of approximation of direct access to reality, even if there's no such thing as direct contact with it. But it is to say that a lot of the work of persuasion and response goes on through these lower level mechanisms. And it would do us all good to remember that when we seek to change behavior and responses of ourselves and of others.
There was a social psychology graduate student at Yale, I actually honestly forget who this was, who was concerned by the fact he did poorly on the IAT. And so he tried to train himself using positive exemplars to improve his score in IAT, that is, to get rid of the bad associations. And at the time he did this, I thought this was really, really odd. But I think I'm sort of persuaded that maybe it's not that odd.
In the 1970s, there was all kinds of work done from Free to Be You and Me to encounter groups to attempts to integrate schools, all of which took seriously these insights from social psychology, but I think failed to recognize just how difficult it is to change habits. So I think what was wrong with some of those early projects was not that they misunderstood the structure of the problem, but that they underestimated the challenge of the solution.
I think in some way this brings us back to something which connects the political and social issues back to issues of belief and sort of imaginative entertainment. And what I'm thinking about is something we're both interested in, which is video games. So people
you
take
in practice and I in theory. Yes, go on.
What was that?
Our interest in video games differs only in that yours is in practice as well as theory. And mine
is
in theory.
Yeah, I have no intellectual interest in video games.
I have no practical interest. I don't actually know how to play a video game, but I have great theoretical interest in them.
Okay. Well, good. You could help me then. I play a lot of video games. I play first-person shooters with my kids. I lost a year of graduate school to Tetris. And then I moved up, and now I play whatever's the most recent video game. And a lot of it is a leaf. I mean, I figured it'd be a good time would be had if I was running through some strange alien land shooting aliens, if I wasn't worried about being killed. And so that explains why I like it to some extent. Certainly a flight simulator is a perfect example. Really cool to fly an airplane, but it's a lot of work, and I could die, so I'll just go on the computer and fly an airplane. So it's not a huge puzzle why we like these video games, and at least those sorts of examples. But I'm kind of interested in what you might think of, sort of from a philosophical standpoint, of the effects of these video games. So many psychologists report studies that suggest that these games might have a morally corrosive effect. And I think the studies are suggestive but not decisive, because there's a lot of problems pulling apart correlation and causality. So, you know, rather than go to the data, maybe you could explain it in theory as to what do you think the effects of these games should have?
Well, there's certainly evidence that some kinds of offline simulation are effective ways of training online behavior. The U.S. military makes use of various kinds of video games to train soldiers to respond to situations in certain ways. And sports psychology is also full of essentially video game practice of a kind that then enables real-world performance. And in general, if we want to look at what's effective, we look where the money or the power is, and that is in sports and in the sort of training we want to be able to do of soldiers. So there's certainly good reason to think that some kinds of training which aren't training in the actual practice are going to be effective. But I take it to be a real open question whether the kinds of representations that occur in video games, say, of first-person shooting, are enough like what shooting really is to train up habits of response that would get activated in really simple ways by actual experience. So I take it that it's an open but important question whether the fact that there aren't smells in video games affects how deeply those kinds of experiences are encoded, because presumably life and death situations make use of all kinds of primitive mechanisms, of which smell is one of the most profound. Likewise, it's totally unclear to me that a video game that involves carjacking, or so-called carjacking, has anything to do with the experience of touching metal, being outside, engaging with a large object, and so on. So I think actually that it's an error to think that just because we call it a video game of first-person shooter, that it's necessarily making use of the mechanisms required for first-person shooting or car theft or rape. That said, my guess is that the third of those cases is the most problematic, because it seems to me that the kind of sexual arousal that goes on through simulated experience is most likely to be sort of like what I was saying in the smell case. That is, it really is tapping the same sorts of mechanisms. It really is tapping them as the result of the same sorts of cues. And I would be inclined to think that some of the literature on pornographic representation in video games is indicative of some pretty disturbing results of those. I'm much less clear about what goes on in the so-called violent games, because it's not clear to me that they're arousing the sorts of systems that get aroused in real instances of violence.
Well, I'm going to take an odd position for me. I'm going to argue for the moral problems of video games. Just want to make two points. One thing is, you may be right about smell. That's actually an interesting case. But you could easily imagine realistic cases and video game cases that are almost perfectly overlapping. In fact, the classic science fiction novel Ender's Game turns on the idea of these kids being trained to play a video game, and then they discover later they were actually guiding soldiers in combat. And certainly a game which would involve firing missiles at people, firing missiles at countries, or some sort of tactical game, it could be indistinguishable from how you would do the same things from real life. So I agree. A boxing game, it's going to have very little experiential overlap with really punching somebody in the face and getting punched in the face. But a game where you're firing missiles, the overlap could be a lot tighter. About the carjacking thing, so there's Grand Theft Auto, is sort of everybody's punching bag when it comes to an evil video game. It's true. You're right. Practice on Grand Theft Auto is not going to turn you into a carjacker. But I guess the worry is that it's not the particular motor actions, it's rather it will deaden your visceral response to harming somebody.
Good.
Is that a worry?
Well, I guess I want to say two things back. First, with respect to what I'll call the funny wiring case, and second, with respect to the carjacking case. So, I mean, the story you tell of Ender's Game, of course, it would be possible to wire up the world so that as I wrote a murder novel, what would happen is that in real life, what I was reporting in my murder mystery would occur. That is, there's nothing special about it being a video game in the Ender's Game story that makes something that you take to be a representation actually end up not to be a mere representation. God, could I take it, wire things up so that if I daydream about 10,000 people dying, that all of a sudden 10,000 people die. So I think that point, though, it's an interesting one, and it's especially an interesting one in the context of modern warfare, where we're not making absurd thought experiments, but actually talking about how we guide missiles, that yes, it is possible that as the result of interacting with something you took to be a representation, you could turn out to have been interacting with reality. But that's not a problem with interacting with the representation as such. After all, you could have an inverted video game where for every orphan I feed in the video game, someone dies, and for everybody I murder in the video game, some orphan gets fed. And that would be just another strangely wired up case where what we would be worried about was the real world impact. So the Ender's Game case actually strikes me as not quite demonstrating what you want to demonstrate. But the carjacking point, I think, does demonstrate what you wanted the Ender's Game case to demonstrate. And that connects back up to our earlier discussions of Nazi propaganda and so on, which is that Yes, there are certain sorts of inhibitions we feel in the face of violence. Some of them have to do with fear. Some of them have to do with a kind of interpersonal connection that we feel as the result of looking somebody in an eye. And to the extent that those can be desensitized by the insertion of a representation of a certain kind of habitual activity, when I see a face, I punch it, or when I see a body, I engage with it for the purpose of sexual pleasure, those sorts of new associations can certainly get set into play as the result of any kind of habituation in a virtual world, in a non-virtual world. And in that regard, I certainly agree that there's a danger if Grand Theft Auto comes to be represented in the subject's mind as relating somehow to cars and people and interactions and property and violence and so on.
Right. I mean, in some sense, the video game cases that we're worrying about are not substantially different from the sort of puzzles and moral problems philosophers and theologians have worried about for a very long time. So there's nothing, you know, the worry is that doing it in the imagination is somehow bad. And you might think it's bad just because it's bad, period, or something sullying to a person to, say, fantasize about rape or murder. But it can also be bad in a practical sense, in that it could dull our sensitivities, and then we would be then cruel in the real world. And I guess the worry about video games is that they're remarkably good technologies for dulling one's sensitivities.
That seems exactly right, and certainly the more realistic they come and become, so that it's not a case of coming up with the mapping between what it is that you're doing in the representation and what the reality that would correspond to that would naturally be. To that extent, yes, it does seem to me that there's certain kinds of real dangers. Any kinds of habits you lay down are habits you lay down. It doesn't matter whether you do them in the imagination or whether you do them as the result of experience. They may come faster, they may come more vividly as the result of experience. But it doesn't mean they can't come through imagination. Your earlier remarks about rumination remind me of some of the work on suicide, which suggests that those who are most successful at carrying through their suicide attempts are the ones who have provided themselves repeatedly with precise visual characterizations and routines of what it is that they wanted actually to do. And likewise, when you resolve to confront your boss or your spouse or your mother about something, you might imaginatively rehearse what it is that you're going to say and thereby make it more likely that that's what you'll actually say in the encounter. So the resources of imagination as a kind of priming routine for what it is that you're going to do not in imagination are immensely valuable, and something to which, you're right, the theological tradition has been enormously sensitive. The danger of lusting in your heart was that what it did was bring lust online, and it didn't matter whether it was in your heart or a little bit below that.
I mean, this is why acting and being an actor is a dangerous profession, because you're in the elite business of generating not merely thoughts that are fictional, but actions that are fictional. So, you know, I've heard it said by a dramaturg told me, and so maybe it's true, that people who play, actors who play characters that are in love, fall in love more often than one would expect by chance. And professing love to somebody and pretending, I think, would have an effect that makes you more likely to love somebody. Pretending that you hate somebody, screaming that I hate you, probably causes you to hate them a little bit. And again, you keep drawing the connection with therapy and clinical psychology, and there's another one there, which is one advice to people who are depressed, and this sounds kind of hokey, but it is to act as if you're not depressed. And by virtue of the pretense, by virtue of the leaf, it'll cheer you up a bit. Smiling does make people happier.
That's exactly right. And some of that has to do with what is sometimes called embodied cognition. That is, that our body reads off of itself what it's feeling. If I form my mouth into a smile, my body will think it's happy, and it will come to respond in certain kinds of cognitive ways as well. In addition, the point about actors is a really interesting one, because although, Paul, I'm sure you're right that the literature on acting says if you act like you're in love, you are more likely to fall in love. If you act like you're angry, you're more likely to be angry. Actors also have developed extraordinary skills for circumscribing pretend response from actual response. And it would be very interesting to look both at the work on how it is that, for example, method actors come to cultivate responses that are akin to actual responses as the result of imagery and memory and so on, but also to look at how it is that they're able, to the extent that they are, to quarantine those very, very powerful responses. Because one of the things that actors do seem able to do is to be less affected by those sorts of deep and powerful imagined emotions than others might be. And my guess is that there are two sets of skills that actors are acquiring.
And sometimes they fail. I mean, an example that comes to mind is Christian Bale's rant on the set of Terminator, the most recent Terminator movie, where it's a YouTube thing, very entertaining, you know, extremely unpleasant, where he's screaming at this guy who got in the way of a shot or something. And later, when asked, you know, why he was such a jerk, he says, well, he was caught up in the part of being John Connor's the end of the world or fighting the killer robots and everything. And he couldn't curtail it. He couldn't keep it from bleeding into his regular life.
Absolutely.
And there are cases of actors who have argued that their character, particularly method actors, their character they're playing has profoundly affected how they really are.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. We have one brain and one body, and all the things we do with that brain and body. That said, I think it's extraordinary, and perhaps this is a good way to close, it's extraordinary that given that we have one brain and one body, that nonetheless there is this possibility of cordoning off, at least in some ways, representations that are not supposed to be of the way the world actually is, but are of something imaginary that we recognize as imaginary. And even if our responses to them are more like our responses to actual things than one might antecedently have thought, that they're present at all is an extraordinary and interesting feature of the human cognitive architecture.
One might say it's one of the things that makes us human.
One might say that it's one of the things that makes us human, and it's one of the things that allows us to take pleasure in being human. And I will certainly take pleasure, Paul, in reading your book about pleasure.
Thank you. I will take great pleasure in finishing the damn thing. This has been great, and I guess we just say our goodbyes.
Terrific, Paul. Wonderful to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Wonderful to talk to you.